Good morning. Hawaii's Environmental Court is an example to other states and countries around the world. So says the chair of the IUCN World Commission on Environmental Law. Brazilian High Court Justice Antonio Benjamin joins us later this hour. And Kelly Brinker of the Global Sustainable Tourism Council details the standards and certification tourism officials are being asked to consider. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Bill Sage. There are Hawaiians and then there are Hawaiians. Are ethnic Asians, Africans, and Caucasians born here just as Hawaiian as ethnic Polynesian Hawaiians? Author Judy Rohr stakes a claim. And Kihoala master Jeff Peterson joins us in studio with his guitar. Lucky us.
It's Labor Day, Monday, September 5th, and that's The Conversation. Next, the news. Little Bruce Springsteen to start a holiday. Hope that gave you a bit of a smile, too. Should have seen everyone else in this studio smiling at that one, too. Good morning and welcome to a Labor Day edition of The Conversation. And to my right, Bill Sage. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Well, it's been said that the laborer is worthy of his hire and that we should also judge not lest we be judged. So how's that work for you on this Labor Day?
It's a nice little segue. Thanks very much. And for something, it's a very, very serious issue. Now, today, a group of judges from around the world will consider their place in the justice of the environment. It's a follow-up to the establishment of the Global Justice Institute for the Environment, formed this past April. One of its key goals is to create more capacity. Brazilian High Court Justice Antonio Benjamin is the chair of the IUCN World Commission on Environmental Law. We talked early this morning about the global environmental courts, why there needs to be more of them, and what they face.
We have almost 1,000. Just China established more than 300 environmental courts. And more recently, Hawaii established its own environmental courts. All those courts are being established around the world to face not just local problems, but problems that are related to global trends. For example, climate change, the biodiversity crisis, protecting migratory species. So it's very important that we establish, as we have in other areas of law, a global institution, independent, run by judges, for judges, that is able to convene those judges and assist, especially with training programs, but also in some countries, it's not the case of Hawaii and the United States, in places where judges don't have enough resources in terms of literature and expertise, also to assist in those areas as well.
Do judges, as you talk to them around the world, understand that responsibility to the environment, which is a little different than it's the responsibility to people?
It's very different, not just a little different. And I'll try to explain, but to answer directly your question, I don't think judges at first realize this is a different task. And again, because in environmental law, and especially in respect to the global crisis that we're facing, we don't have much time. So judges, in theory, they could learn by themselves, but this would take time. It's more important for us to have those resources and be able to join hands with the judicial schools that train those judges in order to bring in capacity building. But as I said, this is a different area of law. Well, first of all, because some of the problems, in fact, many of those problems that the judges are facing, are not just local in nature. It's not like the increase of crime in a particular neighborhood or family law issues. that are related to specific people in that jurisdiction. We could go on and on. Several environmental problems, although they might look local, they are regional in nature, and some of them are, in fact, international. So this is one difference, the dimension that those problems might have. And I'm not even speaking about climate change, because this is such a clearly global issue, and we judges, frankly, are not really prepared for addressing climate change. I would say that it's not just we judges, but also the legal, our domestic, our national or state legal systems are not prepared for that. Another difference is the technical complexity of environmental law as opposed to some other areas, more traditional areas of law. And this puts enormous pressure on judges in remote parts of the world. We have to remember some of the most precious natural resources, you know, tropical forests, to mention one. Those most precious natural resources in the world are in quite distant and remote places of Earth. The Brazilian Amazon, for example. I live in Brasilia, and the Amazon is 4,000 kilometers away, over 3,000 miles. So there are several differences, which each one justify by itself the establishment of the Global Judicial Institute for the Environment.
You talked about networking of judges who understand the global implications of what they're being asked to do and what they're being asked to learn. As we look at the United States, with Vermont having established its environmental court in 1990 and Hawaii only last year, are you disappointed in the United States?
Well, I'm not disappointed. In fact, I'm optimistic, because we had Vermont first, as you said, establishing its environmental judges system, and then more recently Hawaii. The reason why I'm optimistic is because the Hawaiian model is much more sophisticated and, in my view, comprehensive than the Vermont. And, in fact, we are using the Hawaiian model as an example to other countries. First of all, this is not a system of administrative courts. For example, the Environmental Protection Agency. That's the case in many countries. So people, society tends to see those judges as not being real judges. Then there is another aspect that is very appealing in the Hawaiian system. The environmental judges begin not with exclusive jurisdiction, but with jurisdiction in other areas as well. So in other words, as the caseload increases, those judges will receive more and more exclusive jurisdiction. In some countries, this, the opposite system has been a problem. For example, in Kenya, the environmental courts were established, but for 4 years they didn't have any cases. They were almost disbanded. And if we establish a progressive system like you did in Hawaii, mm-hmm. this allows for the system, first to get recognition, credibility, more cases, and to strengthen itself. So I'm very optimistic. But, of course, the United States is huge. Vermont and Hawaii are not exactly Texas or California in terms of size of the state. But in environmental law, we have to think not just in terms of size, but also in terms of the natural resources that exist in that state. And if we look at Hawaii, Hawaii is not just the Garden of Eden. If we had a GDP based on natural resources and the number of endemic and endangered species, extraordinary complex environment, Hawaii would be at the top. So I'm optimistic, and I see a strong commitment from the Hawaiians to the protection of the environment. Of course, problems exist, and that's why we judges exist as well, and the legal system is there to mm-hmm. face those problems. But the commitment of the judiciary, the Supreme Court, the federal court, it is quite remarkable.
But clearly you want more from the United States, given the fact that there are many, many beautiful places aside from Hawaii and Vermont, and that should be part of the capacity building. So what is your message to the Hawaii Supreme Court in the meeting that you're going to be having with the justices here? And how do you see Hawaii's model moving through the United States as well as throughout the world?
My first message is to congratulate the Supreme Court and the judges. This is an extraordinary model, not just for the United States, but for the world. And in fact, it's already been advertised by us and by my colleagues around the globe. If you want to establish your environmental courts, look at Hawaii and look at the design of this model. But the Global Judicial Institute for the Environment is not just for environmental judges, because environmental cases are not decided just by environmental judges. Even if you have specialized courts at the trial level, those cases will move up in appeal. So it is important that non-specialized judges like me from the National High Court of Brazil and my colleagues at Supreme Courts from all over the world, both national and state, or even international courts, that we are also part of this capacity building program. Because you don't learn environmental law in depth in law schools as we do with other areas of law. In reality, there are many countries in which environmental law is not taught in law schools. I have just returned from Congo Kinshasa, which has the third largest intact contiguous piece of tropical forest in the world. Environmental law is not taught in law schools. So how can you assign those tasks to judges that are not properly trained? So there, in those places, the task is even more difficult. Mm-hmm. So the Global Judicial Institute for the Environment is to do capacity building for specialized judges, but also for non-specialized judges, including those that are at Supreme Courts.
I want to thank you very much for the time that you were able to give us this morning, and I wish you a very good day.
Well, thank you very much.
Justice Antonio Benjamin of the National High Court of Brazil is the chair of the Brazil U.S. Law Society and the IUCN World Commission on Environmental Law. The colloquium on judges and nature meets this morning. Now, you would think that the man often called the father of biodiversity would come to the IUCN with a message of climate change. Instead, E.O. Wilson says there are two things he fears more: nuclear war and Donald Trump. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth, and happy Labor Day.
And you too. I mean, to talk about what he fears, I mean, it's almost astounding that he didn't come out of the gate with climate change. But as a former professor at Harvard and a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, he's now 87. And sometimes when people are older, oftentimes they feel that has given them the right to say exactly what's on their minds. So
that would be exactly the case. And I tell you, he sat down with our Nick Ruby and Christy Angela from the Huffington Post Hawaii and kind of let loose. He has a sense of humor, but he was quite frank. He thinks that Donald Trump is definitely a threat, along with nuclear weapons. But he said he thinks Trump is going to lose to Hillary Clinton, so that is less of a concern. He's really much more worried about nuclear disaster. You know, in addition to climate change, mass extinction is another concern here. Well, with nuclear weapons, we're talking about the extinction of human beings as well. So that is his fear, people with access to the nuclear codes that are unstable.
He's also talking about, though, at the same time, wanting to set aside much more of the earth for natural habitat, and so that nature can proliferate as it will. That seems to be quite a dual message.
It's called the half-earth concept. He even wrote a book to that effect, and that's exactly right. He would set half of the planet aside. Remember, that would include oceans, where you would that area would stay undisturbed by humans. Now, we're not quite there yet, but many of the people here at the conference noted that just expanding Papahānaumokuākea was a major step in that direction. So there's a lot of hope at the conference that something like Half Earth might succeed.
I loved what he had to say, that we're going green, but it's a pastel green at the moment, even though it's still green. I love that.
Yeah, he says public awareness is catching on. People are starting to learn. But then there's people like, he singled out specifically Republicans in the Congress who are in denial about climate change. He says they're not ignorant. They just don't want to be negatively impacted financially or politically. So E.O. Wilson not holding back with his views.
And if we want to see a clip of that, we can do that on Civil Beat.
That's right. It's up there today.
All right. Thanks very much, Chad. I'll see you later over at the Congress.
Thanks, Stephan. Bye-bye.
Every day we bring you a reality check with Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:19. Coming up, so who really is Hawaiian? But first, your backyard quiz.
This world-renowned ukulele maker from Hawaii is known for their high-quality koa instruments, beginning with humble roots as a one-man operation out of a basement in Kaimuki 100 years ago. This company's instruments have been preferred choices for well-known ukulele virtuoso Jake Shimabukuro and even George Harrison, a member of the Beatles. If you've seen the Hollywood film 50 First Dates, you would have seen Adam Sandler serenade Drew Barrymore on a six-string model made by this company. A family-owned operation now in its third generation of luthiers, this company is still committed to the guiding philosophy of their grandfather and founder. If you make instruments and use a family name, don't make junk. Today's backyard quiz question is, what is the name of this ukulele company and who was its founder? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt. If you were born here and your ancestors were born here four generations ago, and were citizens of the Hawaiian kingdom, but their parents were born in the United States, are they any less Hawaiian than Hawaiians whose ancestors who came from Polynesia 40 generations ago? Author Judy Rohr, in her latest book, Staking Claim, analyzes Hawaii at the crossroads of competing claims for identity, belonging, and political status. She argues that the dual settler colonial process of racializing Native Hawaiians and indigenizing non-Hawaiians enabled the staking of non-Hawaiian claims to Hawaii. That might sound a little complicated, but it's not really. And Professor Judy Rohr joins us by phone this morning. Aloha, Judy.
Aloha.
So, to put these out of the hyperboles range, so...
it's dense, I know.
I know, but hey, we're not dense. We play in the Akamai. So the object here is a different power comes in with political aspirations and co-opts the original population. Okay, so I guess to put it back into layman's terms, what happened?
Yeah, so I think the best way to think about what I'm trying to do in this book is to study some of the way that non- Hawaiian claims are staked in the islands, right? So that's why it's called staking claim.
Mm-hmm.
And those claims are claims to belonging, they're claims to ownership, there's claims to home in the islands. And in particular, for me, I'm interested in the way that race, and I'm thinking about that through racial discourses and racializing processes, right? The way that categories of people become race, the way that race is used as sort of a major peg in the staking of these non-Hawaiian claims, right? And then that makes it much harder then, right, for us to be able to recognize the Kanaka Maoli claims to mm-hmm. Hawaii as homeland and as nation.
sort of like by racializing, making them like a tribe as opposed to a kingdom or a nation?
Right. So there's I think there's a couple of ways. So like you said in the beginning, that sort of these dual processes, right? So the way I'm looking at the way that we racialize Native Hawaiians and then the way that we indigenize non-Hawaiians, and that both of those processes help for non-Hawaiian folks to be able to claim Hawaii. And
yeah.
The racializing of Native Hawaiians, right, that happens in a couple of ways. I mean, we all know the colonial stereotypes, right, of lazy, unintelligent, uncivilized, right, non-akamai,
yeah.
Right? And those stereotypes really helped the Haoles overthrow the kingdom, right? And we still, those stereotypes continue to be perpetuated today. Everybody talks about Hawaiians are fighting amongst themselves, right? That discourse continues, right? So we have that stereotype. And then we also have these court decisions, right, like the Rice v. Cayetano decision and the way the battles that Kamehameha School has had to do, where folks are arguing that Kanaka Maoli are a racial group, right, and that any kind of entitlement or preferences for Hawaiians are somehow race-based and therefore unfair.
The implication, right? That it's effectively, under by American standards, reverse racism, sort of?
Right. Right, that's exactly right. So it's like this anti-affirmative action, reverse racism, you know, story that gets transported from over here on the mainland to Hawaii, and then they try to use that to keep Hawaiians from being able to talk about the history of colonization that happened there and to make claims for cultural revitalization, right, for sovereignty, for self-determination.
So I guess a good question to ask is, so who is Hawaiian by your definition?
Yeah, so, right, I heard Beth Ann's introduction about that. So the purpose of my book is exactly not to answer that question,
okay.
Bill, right, because that is not my kuleana, right? Mm-hmm. I'm Haole. And so for me, it's important that those of us who are non-Hawaiian, that we need to really be self-reflective about who we are, what is our genealogy, and what is our kuleana to Hawaii, right? And so I think too much of the time, we want to focus on Hawaiians and talk about problems of Hawaiians and try and define who Hawaiians are, and that's not what we should be doing, right? We gotta take responsibility ourselves for who we are and what our responsibility is, because those of us who are non-Hawaiian, we're all benefiting from
I guess a good question to ask at this point would be, what outcome would you like to see?
Yeah, that's a super good question. So, for me, the research and the activism I do, I'm really just trying to be part of moving conversations forward about how we are building towards a decolonial future in Hawaii, right? How that is a future that is just and sustainable, right? And it recognizes that Hawaii is Hawaiian land, right? It recognizes that the Kingdom of Hawaii was illegally overthrown. It recognizes that we need to find ways to support cultural revitalization and self-determination and sovereignty. But it's not for us to lead that, right? Those of us who are non-Hawaiians, it's for us to like I said, to figure out our kuleana in that and to move forward. And we're going to make mistakes, right? But we have to talk about it, right? And all of us have to talk about it. All of us who are in Hawaii, we got to figure it out.
We have a lot of folks who are hapa, and there's so much blending going on. Do you think there might be a new Hawaii? I wish we could talk more, but we're getting kind of close to the time limit.
Yeah. So, you know, anybody who has ancestry, right, gets to talk about their genealogy and takes their kuleana from that. And so, right, that's the way that I think racial discourses, right, when you start talking about race and mixing and stuff like that, it pulls us away from a Hawaiian understanding, right, of genealogy and ancestry. Yeah, and
okay,
that's really
Judy.
What happened in the Rice case.
I really appreciate your being with us today, and it's a nice kuleana to work on Labor Day, so thanks so much for being with us.
For sure. Happy Labor Day.
You too. Aloha.
Judy
Warwick grew up in Hawaii, is director of the Institute for Citizenship and Social Responsibility at Western Kentucky University. She's also the author of Haoles in Hawaii. More about the book is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
According to Nielsen Research, one in eight of your neighbors listens to Hawaii Public Radio each week. And some of them have gone beyond merely listening and, with their financial support, have made our service available to the rest of the community. Please join us in thanking these good neighbors. Young Chai Song of Honolulu, Merle Clausen of Waialua, and Robert Hansen of Kihei. You too can do the neighborly thing and become an HPR member donor by calling us at 955-8821 during business hours, which would not be today. Or you can just go online and visit us anytime you like at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Back and neck pain are some of the most common reasons people see their doctor. But when is it serious enough to require surgery, and why is that often considered the last resort? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk with an expert about the basics for back care. That's today at 5 on The Body Show.
Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in the simply massive universe around our very small planet. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. We welcome him back now. Hey, Christopher, what's happening?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars and Saturn in the southern sky after sunset. The moon this week will be waxing and approaching its first quarter phase.
Now, there's a news story we're going to learn a little bit more about this week, and it could be the wow signal part two.
Well, we have had quite an exciting year in astronomy so far. First, there was the discovery of the mysterious Tabby star, around which a mysterious object is causing our view of the star to dim. There was also the discovery of an Earth-sized world around our nearest neighbor, Alpha Centauri. And now we have a new story from Russia, a mysterious radio burst coming from a sun-like star around 95 light-years away. What do all of these discoveries have in common? Well, they've got people talking about the possibility of extraterrestrial life.
So what's your take on this thing?
Well, astronomers in Russia using the Rattan 600 radio telescope have claimed to have discovered a strong signal coming from a sun-like star, HD 164595. This signal has caught the attention of experts in the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence community, or SETI for short. Only one other radio burst in history has caused this much stir. It was observed in the 70s, and it is the famous WOW signal.
The SETI organization, so far they hadn't heard anything, or what's the latest?
That's right. The scientists at SETI are exceptionally careful when they approach this kind of finding, and they are not implying at all that this is of alien origin. There are now several radio telescopes across the world that are actively trying to determine the origin of this signal and whether or not it's a one-off. If we do find the signal again, and it's repeating itself, then this could warrant some serious investigation.
I've read that it could also be potentially generated from somewhere here on Earth, and we just don't realize that.
Yes, in fact, there could be a very mundane explanation for this. It's quite possible that while the radio telescope was observing a distant star, a satellite may have passed between the telescope and the star it was observing. And in fact, this signal originated around about 11 gigahertz, which is the frequency used by military satellites to communicate with Earth.
Christopher Phillips, thank you so much for the report.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
If there's one buzzword that peppers so much of our conversation, global to local, it's sustainability. The nexus of tourism and global responsibility is no exception, and over the course of the IUCN World Conservation Congress this week, tourism officials are being asked to consider just where that confluence lies. Kelly Bricker is a professor and the director of the Parks, Recreation, and Tourism Department at the University of Utah. She's also a member of the Global Sustainable Tourism Council. She joins us now in our studio. Good morning.
Aloha.
That's nice to hear, too. Thank you. Now, there's so much talk about sustainability and sustainability in tourism That seems to also lead to conversations about standards and accreditation and being able to be certified in all of that. And yet there doesn't seem to be a lot of commonality in what those standards and certification programs should be. Is there really a movement to be able to network some of these things together?
Absolutely. With the Global Sustainable Tourism Council, one of the primary reasons we're formed is to sort of bring unity to all the noise in over 150 certification programs around the world. There are certification programs that do wonderful things for destinations, hotels, tour operators, other sectors of the industry, but there are also certification programs that are simply marketing ploys. So we wanted to unite the certification programs together, bolster their ability to effect positive change on the ground. And the council does this with a review of 6,000 to 7,000 different criteria that exist around the world today, sifting those down into the primary core pieces of sustainability, and actually asking certifications to follow these baseline ideas.
There are a lot of people who are listening who are wondering, probably the big question, is Hawaii involved?
Hawaii has a ecotourism, I think it's called a sustainable tourism certification program. Hawaii has amazing culture, amazing natural features, but we haven't seen Hawaii strong at the table with the GSTC, and we'd love to engage Hawaii in this conversation.
Hawaii is a destination. We hear a lot about that. We also hear a lot of conversation within the state about who's getting what tourism dollars and what's flowing from that. But the idea that there should be some sort of baseline isn't one that we've really talked about a lot in terms of a global or even a national movement. What do you think Hawaii needs to do to become more involved? Although you'd love to have them involved, but what do you think they really need to do? What does it mean?
I think they need to continue to strengthen the avenues through the Tourism Authority and through these organizations that are supporting sustainability. It appears that there are several ecotourism certified operators. They need to be brought to the table. I think looking at the global sustainable tourism criteria for destinations is an avenue to say, where are we in the global sphere of standards and certification, but also use that to strengthen the channels that are already there. I think some of the conversation that we're hearing is we're not seeing sort of the benefits of the incredible tourism that Hawaii supports flow back to local communities. So there are, it's who wins in all of this, and certainly the benefits need to come back to the residents of the state.
After what you just said, it also sounds as if there's a great deal of redundancy, perhaps, or certainly wasted dollars.
I haven't studied Hawaii to that extent, but I do know that when you start to look at a destination approach, and a destination can be an island, it can be a community, you really start to focus in on the resources that are available and not duplicate. So you start to build off each other and build off strategies and efforts that are being done within the community. So I think that having a destination sort of approach to this idea actually unites and doesn't create repetitiveness. It actually bolsters the things that are happening there already.
And there are examples for that, good ones in the United States.
We've had a program called Early Adopters. And one of those examples I would use is Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And Jackson Hole, about 5 years ago, said, we have these iconic national parks, just like Hawaii has iconic national parks. We have an amazing natural environment around our community. but we're really not all on the same page. So they use the destination level criteria to bring stakeholders together, including the park people, community members, residents, all types of small businesses and large businesses, and said, what do we want for a future? And I think what they found in that process, in sort of developing that future together, was, oh, you're doing this for recycling. Maybe we can combine these efforts. And instead of duplicating these efforts in a scattered way, they strengthen the efforts. They strengthen recycling. They strengthen marketing approaches. They branded together. They've looked at community outreach programs. They've done a lot to, I think, really unite the destination. And I think that's where the effectiveness comes in of using a standard or criteria, sort of bringing all of the stakeholders together, including government.
Well, we're going to see how that message resounds in Hawaii. You've got a cafe today, the Knowledge Cafe, where you're going to be sharing that message, and we'll be watching carefully to see how it's picked up.
Fantastic.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Kelly Bricker is a professor and director of the Parks, Recreation, and Tourism Department at the University of Utah. Also, she's a member of the Global Sustainable Tourism Council and will be participating in a World Conservation Congress 2016 Knowledge Cafe later today at 2:30.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. There are many examples where the donor is generous but wants to ensure the funds go to something specific. However, this was not the case for Jody Payne. She loved the island of Lanai and wanted to give something to the people there. To ensure her gift would provide help where it was needed, she insisted local people chose how it was to be used. This enhanced the already special nature of her altruism and provided a spark that united the community. They decided to build a health center. To successfully complete this task, the community organized, held additional fundraisers, and gathered others to help in whatever ways they could. They came together, and their united effort allowed them to build an enhanced, federally certified health center from which everyone benefited. This reminds me of a song.
Come together right now. Over me.
Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
Early in the show, we talked about some truly world-class koa ukuleles chosen by an ukulele virtuoso and even a beetle. We ask you to give us this company's name as well as the name of its founder. To recap, ukuleles from this company were first built by its founder in a kaimuki basement and is now in its third generation of family operation based out of an expanded factory on South Street. You may have seen and heard a six-string example out of the tradition of its founder while watching the film 50 First Dates. What company crafts such renowned instruments? It's the Kamaka Ukulele Company, founded by Samuel Kamaka in 1916.
And Mark Thacker, called us from on the road to Ko'olina from Manoa, knew the answer, and gets the T-shirt. Thanks very much for joining us for the Backyard Quiz for today. And if you've got a question for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you love what you do for a living, is it really work? And if you're working on Labor Day and people love what you do for a living, that's good work. Especially tonight when Slaiki Master Jeff Peterson and Taiko Master Kenny Endo, along with Shakuhachi Virtuoso Riley Lee, perform tonight at the Blue Note Hawaii Waikiki. Jeff and Riley have been working together for years, but only joined forces with Kenny in 2012 during a week-long residency where each artist conducted intensive workshops. They put together a program of refreshing new music like an island breeze and presented it in concert at UH. That music resulted in the CD recording in 2014 and a Nahoku Hanohano nomination in 2015. Well, Jeff and Kenny are joining us in studio this Labor Day, and they've been getting ready to give us all kinds of treat. Aloha, gentlemen. Welcome.
Aloha. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a feeling that music speaks a lot louder than talking story, although I will say in the background of the ICUCN conference that survival and sustainability seem to be the key for innovating new forms of creativity in all aspects of humanity, such as combining taiko and slack key and shakuhachi. So if you'd like to explain, Jeff, first of all, how you guys meet it and decided to blend it, and give us some wonderful examples with Kenny, too.
Sure, sure. I think Kenny, Riley, and I all have very diverse interests. We've studied the cultural background behind our traditions for a very long time, but we also love the idea of collaboration. And we first got together when Kenny had a taiko intensive in 2012. He invited both Riley and I to teach. And it's usually a taiko class, but he brought in some slack key guitar, and also Riley taught percussion and rhythm. Riley's been a member of Taik Oz in Australia. He moved there to get his doctorate degree, and he promised his wife he'd be there for maybe a couple years. And about 20 years later, they're doing great there. Love it there in Sydney. I've been there to tour and visit with him a number of times. But he usually makes it to Hawaii once a year. So since about 2000, I did my first recording with Riley, and we've done many concerts over the years. We played at Atherton here. We played at Orvis and the Museum of Arts Doris Duke Theater. And the idea of working with Kenny was very exciting for us, and it happened very naturally. We just got together and started playing music and found lots of common ground, lots of mutual interest in music, and just a general excitement to work with each other.
That sounds wonderful. And speaking of sounding wonderful, Kenny, thanks for being here. Now, you like to listen to the drum solo of Iron Butterflies in Agata da Vida many years ago. And
that's right.
You've been beaten and doing gigs for a long time. And tonight, as well as today, you are going to show what Island Breeze is all about. And since, again, the notes and the rhythm speak a lot louder than human speech, I understand you have a little solo taste you'd like to give us, something you call Yume no Paho. Could you explain, or then just explain it?
This is a piece I wrote after I moved to Hawaii. The word yume means dream, and the word pahu means drum in Hawaiian. And this was inspired by a friend of mine, COC, who is a pahu maker. And I dedicate this piece to the native people of Hawaii in support of their struggle for control of their land and culture and destiny.
Without further ado, then, Yume no Paho. Thank you. The only human word I can think of right now is wow, and I wish we had more time, but that's a taste. If you want to hear more, you know where to be tonight. It's an honor to hear you play. It's an absolute sonic delight. Thank you so much, Jeff Peterson. Thank you so much, Kenny Endo, for being here.
Thank you.
Maui-born Grammy Award winner and 7-time Nahoku Hanohanu Award winner Jeff Peterson grew up on the slopes of Haleakala, learning slack key from his Paniono father at Haleakala Ranch. Taiko master Kenny Endo has been amazing audiences for over 40 years. His performances, Dance, Prayer, and Altered State. Jeff, Kenny, and Riley Lee perform tonight as Island Breeze at the Blue Note. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Hashtag Nature for All is a global movement to inspire a new generation of thinkers and doers across all sectors of society to connect with nature and take action to support its conservation. It launched at the opening of the 2016 IUCN World Conservation Congress with support from over 90 partners. And we're talking with Hashtag Nature for All this week. Rebecca Ward is part of the communications team, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what is on tap, as you see it, is one of the, you know, the highlights for today on the Labor Day, where certain people are off and others are going to be there working at the conference. But what do you think is an absolute must-do for the highlight?
Oh, well, you know, this is the closing day of the forum, so there will be a lot of celebration as we go into this evening of all of the things that have been accomplished at Congress. Something that we spoke about this morning in our media debrief with young communicators across Congress was some of the things that they really enjoyed in the last couple of days. And I think that having some key players in the environmental field that they really look up to, even being communicators and conservationists themselves, like Sylvia Earle and Jane Goodall, it's impressive how much impact having those people's voices in person can really have on a young conservationist and communicator. So I would say those are the highlights.
We've heard from people who were just in ways astounded that Jane Goodall was here and certainly Sylvia Earle. But in terms of what happens from just the awe factor to going off and taking action, what do you think happens next?
That's a great question. I think that, you know, Congresses like this always have that kind of a question come up. That's something that we were really trying to discuss within the Nature for All campaign, but I think more broadly within the IUCN community in these 4 days, how to promote especially new audiences to take action. And, you know, quite honestly, I think that that's something that the IUCN as an international organization can encourage, but really it's individual local organizations and communicators who really care about conservation and are able to communicate these messages every day. I mean, it's the small actions in the end of the day. I mean, aside from government actions, which are very important, and the actions of large corporations, it really does take a lot of little actions in order to build up to the kinds of changes we need to see, and we can't forget that.
Or the fact that some of those little actions can be well-networked with people across the globe. Thanks very much, Rebecca. We'll be checking in with you the rest of the week.
Thank you so much, Bethan.
Rebecca Ward is part of the communications team of the IUCN's Hashtag Nature for All campaign. She works for PCI Media Impact, a media for social change organization based in New York City. And that's going to take us to just about the end of this hour. Bill Sage, thank you so much for being there with us. It's we've talked so many things about about the environment, but about the immediate environment, including music today.
It's all in the notes.
It's all in the notes. Well, we've got lots of notes about what's been happening at the IUCN. We'll be continuing to share those with you and hearing also from a Civil Beat down there with a lot of the reality checks that we'll be getting throughout the week, too. So thanks very much for joining us on this Labor Day holiday. Hope you enjoy the rest of it. And know that we'll be back with you tomorrow morning live right here on KIPO and HPR2 across the state. Now, tomorrow we're going to talk about generational world heritage, and we'll also be finding out how that links to Hawaii.
Plus, 1 week after exiting NASA Dome's high sea, crew member Tristan Bassingthwaite.
We'd like to hear from you, and you can get to NAS, get to us anytime you like at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you like social, you can find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of the show or want to pass one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of the Conversation.